You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko India tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mo tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for the Tuesday, the 26th of September, We're taking a look at quite a few different things on my show today, and I'm joined by my producers Mac and Lucy in studio. How are you guys?
Doing well.
Yeah, doing good. Thanks, India.
That's good. Coming off in the show today, we speak to Professor Shane Cronin about the state of emergency in Vanuatu, where a volcano is causing thousands of people to evacuate. We speak to Marama Fox from the Māori Party and Jeff Simmons from the Opportunities Party about how each party fared in the election. On the Green Desk this week, Lily speaks to Auckland University's Dr. Stephen Noakes about China's foreign policy and the environment. PhD researcher Miriam Safer joins us to discuss her research into the slow fashion movement and her success in the three-minute thesis competition. We speak to the founder of Moments, a music collective which prioritises women and the LGBT community in their lineups. And finally, we talk to the woman behind the launch of a new street newspaper for Kay Roads Homeless. If you want to let us know your thoughts on any issues we cover, please give us a call, 309 3879, or tuku pātuhi mai, send us a text on 5395. First up, we have Lucy, who's going to introduce her segment.
Thanks, India. So today I spoke to Professor Shane Cronin from the University of Auckland about the state of emergency on the island of Ambe in Vanuatu. The Geohazards Department has currently raised the alert level from a level 3 to level 4, which basically means that it's now in a moderate eruption state. I started by asking him what this meant in real environmental terms.
So essentially, what they're indicating is that they're concerned of quite a large eruption. So that particular volcano is very high, so there's a lake that's located over about 1,200 metres above sea level, and it's an enormous lake. It's like Crater Lake on Ruapehu, but actually much larger than that. And inside that lake is where the explosion vent is currently operating. So there's explosions going on and so on, and there's gas and a bit of ash around the place. And so what they're saying when it's going to level 4 is that the concern that the explosions might get bigger, or that there might be some interaction with the lake water that might eject lake water and then cause lahars.
Yeah, so there's been talk of acid rain and ash falling. Is this the reason that they're being evacuated, or is there a chance of the alert being raised to a higher level?
Yeah, so the acid rain and the ash fall, you know, the acid rain is associated with the fact that the eruption's through that crater lake, and it's like the Ruapehu Crater Lake, so it's basically a pool of acid water, really, really low pH, and then there's lots of sulfur coming through with the eruptions. And so when that gets erupted, then it gets into the clouds and you get these acid rains. The reason why they have the evacuations in place is that they're trying to move people away from the central part of the island, which is closer to the crater, and also closer to the main watercourses. Because if eruptions become slightly bigger, then water will be thrown out of the crater and into the water sources, and you get lahars. And so those are, you know, really dangerous, and that's essentially why they're moving people away from the areas close to the volcano.
So it's on the island of Ambe in Vanuatu. How big is the island, and how big is the volcano in terms of the island?
Well, the whole island is actually just the top part of the volcano. The volcano absolutely dominates the island, so you can't really get away from it. So the kinds of evacuation they're doing, it's kind of like a long sort of oval-shaped island. The central part is essentially all the central volcano, and then the edges of the oval are all parts of the volcano as well. So in most eruption sensors, it's the central portion of the island, probably about two-thirds of the island, that are affected. So the island is about sort of 15 kilometres across. It's about sort of 40 kilometres long. Mm. So it's quite a substantive island. And that crater lake is sort of right dominated in the middle of it.
So we've seen the Geohazard Department gradually raise the level of alert over the last couple of months. And Vanuatu has obviously therefore been aware of this. Do you think that they're prepared?
So with this particular island, There's been a couple of eruptions in the recent times. There was one about 1999 and there was another one about 2005 and 2006. And so the community on the island have actually been quite proactive in preparing for these kinds of events. And so in the 2005-2006 eruption, in fact, they also had an evacuation and many people moved from the central areas close to the volcano to the sort of north and southern tips of the island, which are further away from the volcano. And they were evacuated, some cases self-evacuated, and they were there for about 3 months during the course of that eruption, and then they moved back again afterwards.
What are the chances from a geological and environmental perspective of the alert being raised from what we know?
Essentially, it depends on how big the eruptions become. And so, you know, there's quite a lot of observation going on at the moment. The seismicity will tell us, so the earthquake shaking will tell us how much magma is rising to the surface and so on. And that may be an indication of greater things to come. But at the moment, the level four has been raised is probably one of the higher levels that you would expect to see given present indications. And something would have to substantively change for there to be a much larger alert level.
From a scientific perspective right now, from what you know, you don't believe it to be a threat in terms of moving up?
Not in terms of moving up, but certainly a threat to people living close by, and it's certainly a threat to the people in the watercourses nearby. But I think what they're doing at the moment is doing the right thing in terms of providing that warning level, and the local communities are doing the right thing in terms of being cautious and starting some sort of evacuations around the close-up area to the volcano.
So there are a couple of other volcanoes in Vanuatu, and we've seen those levels rise, but not beyond a level three. Do you think that those volcanoes are also at risk of moving to a higher alert level?
Yeah, so it's a pretty busy time in Vanuatu at the moment, and I think authorities are quite stretched. You've got Ambrim Volcano, which is to the south of Ambai, and that's a volcano that's an almost permanent eruption. There's actually lava lakes at the top of that volcano, and it's, you know, touristic and constantly erupting. But that one that went up to a high level about a month ago, and that's producing quite a lot of acid rain over on the western side of the island mainly. So that's at a level, you know, slightly heightened level. Lopevi Volcano, which is just to the south of Ambrim, is a little cone volcano. Nobody lives on that, but it's right next to an island where people are living. That one just went up one level as well. Ambrim and Lopevi seem to have relatively small eruptions at the moment, and there doesn't seem to be any indication that they are going to go to much higher levels. And I think the biggest concern in terms of, you know, human health and population is what happens next at Ambai.
What are the effects of the volcano's eruption and the acid rain and the ash on the agricultural economy?
All of these places, and this is true for Ambrim as Ambai, and even, in fact, further down south in Vanuatu on the island of Tanna, all of these areas are subsistence agricultural areas, or there's cash crop agriculture, and people are very reliant on their gardens for food. So the first thing that happens with acid rain is any leafy crop are quickly destroyed, and so acid rain is very, very bad for things like bananas and taro and vegetables like island cabbage and that sort of thing. So it's pretty bad for food supplies. Essentially, we're, you know, just coming out of the dry season. So, you know, this should be a time as we get it, as we move towards the wet season, lots and lots of crops going in. This is, you know, a big time for planting and growing. And, you know, having acid rains or ash fall on gardens is not good news for the local people.
So just finally, what do you think that the forecast will be looking forward?
It could do a number of things. I mean, this volcano has had quite an interesting geological past. What we've seen in the last two eruptions, so the one in 1999 and the one in 2005, was essentially activity at the summit area in that crater lake area. That sort of went on for a few months and wasn't very large, but produced acid rains and so on. Now, in the geological past, there's obviously been some bigger eruptions, and some of them have produced these explosions of water out of the crater to produce lahars or big mud flows down the valleys. And so that would be the next sort of level of concern. If it went beyond just producing ash and acid rain to start producing these lahars. And some other eruptions also in the geological past that have actually produced lava, and the lava has gone down onto the lower flanks of the volcano. Mm. Now, if that starts to happen, then the hazards, in terms of hazards to life, they may not be as bad as, say, the lahars or these big debris flows going down the valleys, but certainly they change the landscape and they're certainly not very good for any structures in the way, and that's the other potential geological concern.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Waia.
Lucy was speaking there with Auckland University's Professor Shane Cronin about the situation in Vanuatu.
It's time to chat politics with Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox.
The Māori Party took a big hit in the election over the weekend, losing both seats it previously held and getting only 1.1% of the vote. Co-leaders Marama Fox and Te Ururoa Flavel were distraught, and Fox hit out against the Labour Party, who won all seven Māori seats. Fox compared the Māori voters who supported the Labour Party to a beaten wife returning to her abuser. Earlier, Fox told me there has been an outpouring of sympathy for the party since Sunday's disastrous result.
We've been inundated with messages of goodwill, messages of told you so, messages of, well, you poisoned your own chalice by going in with the gnats, and messages of just utter love and respect, and especially for Tūturu Flavel. I'm not concerned for myself. I've got a lot of years ahead of me. But Tūturu Flavel has given 12 years in the role as a Member of Parliament, and the last three as the Minister of Māori Development. And what really incensed me, because I might have been a bit grumpy 12 hours after the election result, and that might have showed all over TV when I was on the interviews in the morning.
Do you regret any of that?
Well, no, not really. I mean, what I regret is that that's the lasting image that people have of me. But we were upset and angry for a reason. And I had to sit in the control room watching the previous interviews take place. And here are people saying, you know, Tamati Kofi deserved the win in the seat because he worked tirelessly in the last 3 years. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, please don't compare what Tamati Kofi did in the last 3 years to what Tūturu Flavel has done for his entire life for the Māori movement, not just for the Māori Party, but for standing up against the fiscal envelope, for starting Māori Radio, for being a principal at Tipene College, for being the Minister of Māori Development and standing on every marae across the entire Wairiki region for every tangi, in the kitchen, sweeping the floors, at Matatini, the stage manager. He's a tireless worker for Māoridom. And if working hard is the prerequisite for winning the seat, then he should be the Prime Minister, because he was an absolute soldier for our people. And I had to listen to people say, well, you know, he didn't listen, he didn't work hard enough, and therefore he didn't win. And that's clearly, I believe, not the logic and not the case. I think, yes, we were tainted by working alongside National, and people said, oh, National hate Māori, and look what they've done to us. No, well, hold on now, compare the record. What we're saying is neither are that blinking good for Māori. The only people that have made consistent gains for our people in the last 9 to 12 years have been the Māori Party on behalf of our whānau. And so therefore, to compare National to Labour is not actually the choice. It's about having a vote of faith in ourselves as Māori, that we can succeed as Māori and not inside another political movement.
And I get what you're saying, you know, and maybe that's not the case, but surely the results that we've seen show that in the eyes of the voter, of the Māori voters, that has tainted you. I mean, will you change anything?
Oh, don't worry, there'll be a great dissection, I'm sure, of everything that's happened, and a regrouping. And what we have had is an outcry from across the Māori political spectrum who are saying, what have we done? we had the opportunity, and so why haven't we got the party back in there? And so all of that internal angst and the reviewing and also the external conversations will be had. over the next few months.
But how did that happen in the first place? Because, you know, you've always said that this decision to sit at the table, it's one that you'd gone to your party and your people and considered and decided that that was the best outcome for the Māori Party. I mean,
you misunderstand, you see. We go to our people when we're invited to the table. If we didn't, we would sit in opposition. So here's the choice. Either you can go to the table and make an agreement of confidence and supply, which sits you outside of government but next to the government, right? So you don't get to make all the decisions, but we agree at the beginning what things we will let you have. And so we negotiate for ministerial warrants, we negotiate for budget share, we negotiate for sort of the policy direction and decisions. And once that's done, well, that's out. Everything else is the government's responsibility, and what we do is push and push and push and push to try and get them to move in the right direction or to listen, and that we don't always win those fights. So what we are going to our people with is a decision to sit in, for the last three terms, to sit in opposition or to sit at the table. And our membership have clearly, for the last three terms, said we'd rather have you there than not, even if that means political suicide, because we can't imagine what it would look like without you there if not. And remember that when National first came in, they were campaigning to get rid of the Māori seats. And now here we are faced again with another vote catcher with Winston at the helm dictating his terms. And so again, we are left and confronted with losing the Māori seats. And so if the New Zealand wants to know what that looks like, to have a right-wing government without the Māori Party, well, if everything pans out according to what the pundits are saying, then we may just be up for that. Listen, I do want to say, look, we know that emotions were running high, and it was very difficult to sit there and accept mournful congratulations from the Labour caucus who were sitting in the green room prior to going on, knowing that their one goal was to get rid of us, as articulated over and over and over again, and then yet they were sad to see us go. I'm like, are you kidding? This is what you wanted. And so, yes, emotions were running high, and I apologise for, I apologise absolutely for being angry birds on the morning after the election, less than 12 hours after the result. And I've calmed down now, and the sun has risen and the day is smiling, and we're going to go build houses for our nation and make sure that our people have dry, warm, safe places to live in.
That was Marama Fox for the Māori Party.
The Wire.
It's 20 minutes past 12. You're tuned into The Wire. After this, we'll have The Green Desk with Lily Peacock.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so 20th century. BFM's best shows, features and interviews are now available as podcasts on RSS and Apple. Yours to cherish forever.
Welcome to 95 BFM Top 10. Yours, Pearl.
Fashion. Turn to the left.
On Land of the Good Groove. Got lined up three songs.
Yo, 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 welcome back. It's True School.
Why?
I don't know.
Well, you're kind of a mellow beginning to the year.
Welcome to the Saturday 2 to 4. My name is Sarah. I will be...
Greetings and welcome. This is the Rhythm Selection and... It's just gone.
Never miss out again. Becasts, available now on Apple Podcasts or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
Glenn, what are you doing? You've been in there since 1 o'clock.
Mum, get out.
What are you... Oh my God, Glenn, you're completely soaked in gin.
Mum, it's just music.
God, you're dripping eclectic tunes and handpicked vinyl everywhere. Do you even know what genres you've been trying?
Mum, it's genre free.
Sweet Jesus, come on, into the shower. You're sweating music everywhere.
The Tuesday 1 to 4 show with Jen. 3 hours of genre-free musical exploration for your Tuesday afternoon. Right here on 95BFM. Sit back, open your ears, and let it all soak in.
Make yourself a oneness with the loving earth. It's time for The Green Desk with Lily Peacock on 95BFM.
I'm here with Dr. Stephen Nooks, a senior
lecturer, not senior, senior
not
lecturer.
Yet.
Okay.
Soon.
Soon to be senior lecturer on Chinese politics at the University of Auckland. And we're here today to talk about China and the environment, which is quite interesting, especially given Trump's recent speech at the UN and stepping down from the Paris Agreement. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Let's maybe start with a bit of background on Chinese foreign policy, which is something that you lecture in at the university. Can you give me just a quick overview of what that looks like?
Well, the Chinese foreign policy around the world is premised on a couple of central principles, non-conditionality and non-intervention in the politics of states with which China has relations. Mostly that is a function of China's own national psyche and the experience of quasi-colonialism that began in China in the 18th century and didn't really abate until midway through the 20th.
So 1949 with the establishment of the CCP and all of that going forward.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, during the early decades of communist rule in China, much of Chinese foreign policy was determined internationally by socialist ideology. And it was other countries of that political bent with which China initially had most of its contact. That sort of fell away by the 1970s as China became more pragmatic about the kinds of diplomatic relationships it had around the world and opened up ties with the United States.
And now we're in a position where China has influence all over the world and is almost, but not quite, another superpower to kind of rival the US's hegemony.
Yeah, I mean, China is now the world's second largest economy. Not necessarily on an individual household purchasing power scale, but by volume overall. And it is the world's largest emitter of carbon outputs. Still a well-known human rights violator, and is home to roughly a fifth of all of humanity and more than half of everyone in the world living in a non-democracy.
Well, that's pretty overwhelming stats because that makes them very influential. And talking about their rise to power, they obviously need energy to fuel that industrial growth. And this has influenced some of the foreign policy initiatives that they've taken, especially in places like Africa.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, China traditionally has been heavily reliant on coal because it's what China's own domestic conditions actually support. It's what China has the most of. And that has carried with it the effects that are now clearly visible in China's own environment, but also pushed China in more recent times towards being an energy leader in other fields. China has been much quicker to embrace solar technology, for example, than the United States has been.
And how are they going on that development front? I mean, China is a place that could really turn around huge energy resources if it really invested in these types of things. And it is becoming one of those leaders in terms of diplomacy. But how is it going actually when we look at their energy uses and resources?
To be honest with you, I'm not exactly certain what precise components of the Chinese energy market are made up by which type of energy. I don't have the latest facts and figures on that. I can simply say that China has invested in alternative energies in ways that other traditional leading economic powers have not. The United States has been quite slow on the uptake relative to China.
Especially since the election of Trump as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's likely to remain the case for the foreseeable future. The U.S. is likely as anything to divest from some of those alternative energy sources. All the while, China is picking up steam, both economically and environmentally, by proving itself to be a global leader in these areas.
And now, going over to maybe some of the more of the polar issues, and I mean polar as in like Antarctic and Arctic, China has been growing their presence there scientifically and investing in building infrastructure down there for some time now. What do you think some of the goals there could be? I mean, is it just to step up into that vacuum that the US is leaving by Trump stepping down from taking that role as the kind of funder of research in the area, or could there be alternative goals there, or what's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm far from an expert, but I would just say that I think yes to all of the above. There's a number of overlapping drivers behind this, one of which would be a genuine desire on China's part to play a stronger role in scientific enterprise. Another might be drive for resources of one sort or another. Partly, I imagine much of the motivation is also about prestige. And this is intimately tied to scientific advance and technological advance, that there is prestige and reputational gains to be had by playing a greater part in these processes.
So going forward into the future, last question before we wrap it up, what can you see for China and its relationship to the environment, climate change, and energy?
I think what you're going to see is China, because it's able to do so and willing to do so, making much larger investments in green technology and really cementing its position as a global leader in this area. The United States, for any number of overlapping reasons, is simply not willing or not able to make these similar kinds of investments. And the state-dominated model of development that exists in China facilitates a sort of green rise that is really unthinkable in many other parts of the world.
Especially with market-led economies, which need that kind of capital investment from the first part. With China, you've got state-led initiatives and policy that back it up and can enforce it, right?
So yeah, I mean, in many ways, economic and environmental detriment is a politicized issue in China, often in ways that people in the Western world don't see or don't understand. I couldn't really sit here and say nobody is concerned about the politics of the environment in China. That's patently false. But the institutional and legal landscape of China make reinvestment in environmental cleanup, in green technologies, in alternative energies of whatever source, a thing that's much closer to reality than is possible in the US.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, for coming up today.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've been listening to The Green Desk with Lily Peacock on 95 BFM.
After 10 months of campaigning, the Opportunities Party gained 2.2% of the vote after the election, meaning they fell well below the 5% threshold needed to gain a seat in Parliament. I spoke to the party's deputy leader, Jeff Simmons, this morning about what's next for the party, whether he'll be taking over the leadership from Gareth Morgan, and why he believes the Greens should consider a coalition with National. I began by asking him about his reaction to Saturday's results.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we're disappointed to not have made the 5%, but, you know, we are quite heartened with our progress, really, in 10 months' time to be where we're at. You know, not many... I haven't actually checked previous parties' results, but I have a feeling we're around about the best for a new party in their first election. And, you know, like I said, after 10 months in, we're pretty happy with that. And also feeling like we have shifted the conversation a bit, so, you know, made a positive impact.
So you weren't surprised that you didn't get closer to 5%, or were you hoping for a bit more?
Well, yeah, we were hoping for more, and, you know, there's been quite a lot of discussion, as you'll be aware, in recent times about exactly how accurate the polls would be. But I think what we've seen in this election is that turnout has stayed quite, you know, quite low, relatively speaking, in terms of, you know, particularly... There was not, you know, it appears there wasn't any sort of youth quake. There wasn't any sort of, you know, massive increase in youth voting. I mean, depending on what happens with the special votes that come in the next couple of weeks, things might shift a bit. But I think everyone's pretty clear that we haven't had the massive changes in turnout that we've seen overseas. And that's really been the key reason why polls have been so inaccurate, because, you know, they haven't been able to be weighted for a massive increase in youth turnout. But, you know, from what we have seen, our support has been hugely, almost entirely coming from the young. So that gives us, you know, confidence in the future.
Looking back on your campaign, is there anything that you would have done differently if you were going to run it again?
I mean, we haven't sat down and had a formal debrief as yet, so it's a bit difficult to answer that question. But, I mean, I think what we have learned is that what young people really appreciate in what we're trying to do is the sort of the non-partisan, evidence-based nature of what we're trying to do. You know, that they are against party political politics and the sort of tribalism that they see from other parties. So the more that we can do in that respect is really sticking to our guns there and keeping things positive and talking about the issues.
And you and Gareth, it looks like both of you think that the Greens should seriously think about a coalition with National. What's your reasoning behind that?
Well, we've really ended up in the worst case scenario that we've been warning against the entire campaign, you know, which was New Zealand First, National. You know, that looks like the most likely outcome. I mean, hopefully, you know, hopefully other things are possible, but a National New Zealand First coalition will, there's one thing I'm certain that will be a disaster for the environment. What policies Winston does have on the environment are not hugely helpful. So that's my real concern here, is that, you know, the next 3 years the environment takes a hammering. I would think that just about any other combination of parties in Parliament would do a better job than New Zealand First and National would. It's not just the Greens, you know, Labor could step up too. We could have a grand coalition. I mean, as we've said before, Labor and National have more in common than any other two parties in Parliament, you know. Labor and National have more in common than Labor and the Greens do, to be honest. So it's not just the Greens. I guess the focus is on the Greens primarily because of the concern about the environment, that a National New Zealand First coalition would just be so damaging for the environment that the Greens might see the sense in stepping up and trying to stop that happening.
And what's next for the Opportunities Party? Are you looking at taking the leadership position?
Yeah, well, I mean, first we all need a bit of a break and a holiday just to sort of get over the campaign. I mean, it's a lot of fun, but an awful lot of work. So I think everyone needs a bit of time to you know, take a breather and you know, before any long-term decisions are made. I mean, I've certainly made it clear that I am happy to act in a caretaker role for the party going forward in the immediate future. But what the party needs to do is really develop its constitution and develop a leadership selection process. And then, if you know, once that is done, I'd like to see if I thought I was the best person for the job, then I would like to have an actual mandate. So I'd like the party to elect me as leader rather than just assuming the mantle. So, you know, a lot of work to do in the meantime. Like I said, you know, getting regional structures and a constitution and a real party up and running. But once that's done, then I'd see whether it was appropriate for me to put my name into the hat.
The Wire.
That's funny. What does it sound like?
That was Jeff Simmons speaking about the future of the Opportunities Party. Next, PhD researcher Miriam Seifert recently won a national 3-minute thesis competition where she summed up her research on the slow fashion movement. She hopes to use her research to make a positive impact on the fashion industry, which she says is the second biggest environmental polluter after oil. Before she heads to compete in the Asia Pacific competition, she joined me to chat about the focus of her research, which she says was inspired by a documentary she came across.
When I first wanted to start with my PhD, I actually wasn't sure really what topic I was choosing, and I was at that time actually taking a year off to think about a topic, and I was looking for a documentary at that time for my students because we had sustainability in marketing. And yeah, I found a documentary which was called The Lightbulb Conspiracy, and that was talking about that at some stage about 100 years ago, we actually made stuff that was made to last and lasted for a very long time. And there was this one example of this light bulb that is still burning in the United States and has never been actually burned out. So I thought at that time, that would be actually really interesting if companies would actually make something that would last and that would create loyalty in customers and possibly still be beneficial or profitable for these firms. So yeah, that's how it pretty much started up. And then while I was reading, I came about a topic on Patagonia, an American outdoor clothing retailer that ran an advertisement on Black Friday in the United States, which stated, don't buy this jacket. And that was very controversial because Black Friday is usually the day when everyone goes shopping in the United States. So I thought, wow, that is actually very interesting because it actually demarkets the actual product and they actually want customers to think about what they actually buy and not just buy something because they think they want it, but actually just buy something because you need it. So yeah, that's how I came about the topic and that's how, yeah, it just all started up.
What are some of the interesting things that you've come across during your research?
In the beginning, I wanted to have my research about both fast and slow fashion because I thought it would be very interesting to see if companies adopt actually this anti-consumption sentiment that consumers have. And anti-consumption is about when you and I consciously choose not to buy something because of our personal values, for example, or because we made a bad experience with a product and hence we say, oh, we don't want to buy this anymore. And I just wanted to see if fast fashion companies actually take on this feedback from customers on why they potentially don't buy their clothes and how that actually is visible then in their operations. However, the problem was then that I didn't get access to fast fashion companies because they didn't want to open up and talk about it. So the other thing was then because I saw that there was like this huge two-sided kind of phenomenon happening between fast and slow fashion. And slow fashion is a bit about reducing consumption overall and actually slowing down production of companies, meaning that you actually don't produce as much as fast fashion, but that you produce it more consciously by knowing, for example, where it is made and who made it. Because after Rana Plaza, which is this big Bangladeshi factory that collapsed in 2013, a lot of companies said, we don't want to have fast fashion anymore. We actually want to open up a business that is possibly actually having a positive impact on the environment, on people, on society. So yeah, I found then this other side on slow fashion. And the very surprising thing was that people were actually so friendly and yeah, so willing to actually be interviewed and participate in my research that I ended up in the end with almost 50 companies that I interviewed. And yeah, they were all very, very passionate about actually changing the world, having a positive impact, producing locally instead of actually just producing overseas. Because when you produce overseas, there are lots of supply chain issues with who made it in the end? Where are my suppliers actually coming from? Because you often discuss just with a middleman, possibly, where or who will be supplying your raw materials. So that was one of the major findings that a lot of people said local production is something that we actually do. But also at the same time that a lot of these companies do social marketing, meaning you see, for example, the advertisements on TV where don't drink, don't drive. These companies use that a lot as well for their own purpose, like Patagonia did, for example, with the Don't Buy This Jacket ad, to just actually create awareness around the impact of the fashion industry. Because the fashion industry is actually the second most polluting industry in the world after oil. Within the slow fashion movement or within the sustainability movement, there is a new business model that also actually arises out of that. Because, you know, the traditional business model for businesses is about that we actually make as much money as possible overall. You know, we're in business to make money overall. But there is this movement of a business model that's called Benefit Corporation. And there are also companies here in New Zealand that actually have been certified Benefit Corporation. So it's a certification that you get. And Benefit Corporation is about, okay, you still have to sustain itself or yourself as a business, hence you make money, but at the same time, it is just as important to do something good for society as well as the environment. So you make sure that you fulfill pretty much the sustainability tree of triple bottom line, people, planet, and profit by incorporating a business model that is not just business not just business focused or profit focused.
So it's sort of redefining what a successful business looks like.
Exactly,
and
yeah,
giving some weight to that as well.
Yeah.
So what are you hoping to get out of your research? Are you hoping to kind of share this message with consumers or is it with other businesses?
Both, actually. I would like to share my research with both consumers as well as businesses. Because I think at some stage we have to change towards something if we want to create a world where people in future are able to live with the same resources that we currently live. So I think it's important for us to create awareness in both consumers as well as firms.
Did you speak to any New Zealand companies?
I did, quite a few actually. And yeah, they are very, very good examples of companies that actually do quite a good job in terms of producing locally or producing more consciously by making sure that your workers are not underpaid and exploited, as well as what kind of fabrics you might use. Because I don't know whether you knew, but while I was doing actually a lot of interviews, a lot of people told me that when you actually have conventional cotton. Conventional cotton is filled with lots of pesticides, and there haven't been really lots of studies on it, but I think there would be future research that could be very interesting on that in terms of like what conventional cotton actually does to your skin. Because the people that I've interviewed, a few of them said that they actually started because they saw consequences of wearing conventional cotton because it caused cancer. There were people that were sick, they had cancer, and then they analyzed the skin and they saw actually that there was polyester, so polyfibers, as well as cotton fabrics below the skin that partially actually caused the cancer. So it would be very interesting to see in future in terms of like, well, what we wear, what influence it has on us in the end.
Yeah, so it seems like there are so many levels to why slow fashion is such a great movement. But how, so for the 3-minute thesis competition, how did you go about condensing, how many years of research is it?
Well, it's overall at the moment a bit more than 2.5. I didn't actually really know what the 3-minute thesis was about. I thought, okay, it's 3 minutes condensing your thesis, but I didn't really know what it included overall in terms of like, do it has to be dramatic or can I just actually talk very clearly about what I have done? But then I found out actually that there has to be a drama part to it. And so I wrote up what I thought was important in terms of like a little story, because I watched beforehand a lot of 3-minute theses and what a good 3-minute thesis would look like. So I thought about, first of all, the negative impacts that the fashion industry has, and then linked it back towards my research. And I thought that was, yeah, quite a good move to do it that way, because it helped me to a bit condense and make it as easy as possible for others to understand. Because I wrote up first everything and then I thought, okay, that's a bit too long. Maybe I just have to cut out a few things, and also cut out obviously all the things that are too technical that people wouldn't understand.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was Miriam Seifert discussing her PhD thesis, on slow and fast fashion. It is 12:44.
Do you ever think about space? How it's just, you know, so unknowable and awesome?
I guess so. I guess I get confused about what's still a planet.
I know, right? Oh, and the stars. The insignificance of, like, us.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, speaking of space, I'm the only person on this whole bus. You don't need to sit right here on my lap.
Sorry, I was thinking about the cold, unknowable void.
Spaced out. David Britton from Auckland's Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. Every other Tuesday on 95 BFM Drive.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
You're changing to The Wire. Auckland's Karangahape Road is set to have its own newspaper, the K Road Chronicle, written by and for the homeless community. The monthly 8-page paper will focus on issues affecting the homeless, and they will receive a bundle of the papers to sell for koha, keeping all the proceeds. Funded by the K Road Business Association, the venture is the brainchild of Six, a former homeless person herself who joins us now in the studio. Hi, Six.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. So for those who aren't familiar with your work, whether it's through your blog or on public address, do you want to explain a bit of your background and maybe how you got to this point?
Yeah, I studied journalism at Waikato Institute and got my diploma down there and struggled to find work, and came back to Auckland. And WINS actually said I had to be on a course, otherwise they were going to cut my benefit off. And I was like, well, what sort of course do I need to be on? They said, well, we can put you on a literacy course. I was like, I'm a published journalist. So I enrolled at the AUT postgraduate diploma in communications, majoring in journalism. And they were just fantastic. I was homeless while I did that postgrad qualification. And the reception to me has been not too welcoming with the mainstream media, and it's not just for the homeless, it's for the fringe, really. Like, we've got stories coming out on the volunteers that work at the NZPC, the Prostitutes Collective, got stories about the K Road Business Association and their approach to homelessness, and like got stories about like the street cleaner who we see every day, but what's his story? What does he do? You know, and I think it kind of came out of a project that LifeWise did back in May, which I was involved with, called Rough Rag, and it was all community-based stories that, you know, the mainstream media are not too interested in covering, and that had a huge response. So ever since May, I've been on at LifeWise. When are we going to do another one? When are we going to do another one? And you know, I just get sick of these talk fests. So I decided, screw it, I'm just going to pick up the bat on my own. K-Road Business Association, I wouldn't say it's sponsored by the K-Road Business Association, but they were the first to come up with an offer of some funding. Other people have come out of the woodwork with funding. Stuff did that story last week. Southland Times have done a story. The support has been huge. And it, for me, it's a way of making a real difference to the fringe community. So it's not for profit. All profits will be returned to the community through direct action initiatives. I mean, nothing against the Auckland City Mission or LifeWise, but if I give them $1,000 or $2,000, whatever, I don't know what happens to that money. So I would much rather go out and buy, you know, $1,000 worth of nice coats. Or I was talking to Wilf at the Auckland City Mission, who are a supporter of this project, and he said, you know, we move people into houses and they might not have a toaster, so, you know, we'll go and buy toasters. We'll make a real difference. And it's loosely based on the big issue, which is done overseas, and the guys on the street will get a bundle of newspapers, so explicitly they get the help from the koha, whether it's 10 cents or $10, get a newspaper, and implicitly you get informed about the issues that affect the fringe community. You know, because a lot of times it's not the big things. It's, you know, hey, where am I going to brush my teeth this morning?
Right.
Where am I going to have a shower? And all those little things that, you know, we just take for granted when we've gone home. So.
And it's going to be K-Road focused, right?
It's K-Road focused because that's manageable for me. I mean, at the moment, it's really just me and a few volunteers that are putting it together. But if I get the model right, there's no reason why we couldn't expand to Queen Street or Victoria Street down in Hamilton. I've already been approached by people in Wellington wanting me to help them set up a similar project. And I'm like, well, slow down a bit. Let's make sure this first one's a success. And if the model works right, I think it could be applied to different things as well, not just newspapers, but, you know, maybe those small commodities that we need on a regular basis, like, you know, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, but, you know, aspirins or, I mean, we'll stick with publishing for now, but, you know, there's no reason why the model couldn't be adapted. I mean, the big issue are doing coffee now over in England, so... Mm.
I think it's funny because we're talking about, you know, coming up with new funding models for the media to save, you know, us from the newspapers no longer making as much money. But here you are with a newspaper as kind of a new funding model for the homeless community, right?
Yeah, and it's actually an old school model. You know, like everyone's like, oh, am I going to be able to get this online? It's like, no, why would I want to put the copy online? I want to direct people to the newspaper. Then down the track, we might do an online kind of behind the scenes sort of thing. But the actual content, it's good quality content. It's got journalistic integrity and value. And I've already been talking behind the scenes with some guys from Stuff about how we can work in with them as well. So there's huge support for it. And I think that, you know, there's a place for a tactile newspaper that you can pick up, you can put in your bag, you can read it on the bus. You don't have to download it. And remember, there's still a huge proportion of the community that are technically illiterate. They don't have access to the internet, and they wouldn't know how to how to log on to stuff. And, you know, it seems odd from our point of view, but there's still a huge part of the community that they want paper, you know, not online.
Yeah, and so when can we expect to see the first issue?
First issue comes out next Friday, Friday the 6th.
Yeah,
we're aiming to do an issue every the first Friday of the month within the first year, and then hopefully within a year to 6 months we'll go fortnightly, because depending on the time period, depends on the type of articles you can publish as well. Like we're doing a lot of human interest type stories that hold for the month. Yeah, whereas we couldn't put in a review of a concert that happens, you know, the beginning of the month, and then, you know, 2 days later the concert's gone, so you can't get it. So what's the point? So it's more magazine style articles, I guess.
Yeah, and people can pick it up from K Road, presumably.
It'll be available from K Road. I'll be dropping copies off at AUT, Auckland University, Auckland Library. It'll be available from street vendors via Koha. It's, you know, most places it'll be either free or it'll be, you know, via a Koha. And that doesn't matter if it's 10 cents or $10.
Mm. Well, that's great. Look very much forward to the first issue, and thanks so much for coming in, Six.
Oh, thanks for your guys' support. It's awesome.
Yeah, cheers.
Oh, just a wee plug for transpotting.wordpress.com. That's my blog. That's very much in a gonzo style. It's an award-winning blog. So if you want to know the style of articles, that'll give you a giggle and maybe a cry.
Yeah, do recommend it.
And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Music promoter Emma Hall Phillips is the founder of Moments, a collective which prioritises women and the LGBT community in their lineups. She aims to create safe spaces and make sure all artists are treated with respect after experiencing several instances of sexism as both an artist and promoter. Emma says she started Moments as she knew she wasn't the only one to have experienced this, and there weren't any other collectives in New Zealand making diversity a priority.
But I've always put on shows before Moments was a thing, and I guess I kind of wanted to make it the thing. I was really inspired by the New York collective Disc Woman. They're like a bunch of DJs, and they're also a booking agency, and they like do really amazing shows basically all over the world now. So I guess that was like my main source of inspiration and why I decided to start Moments.
So was it in response to like a kind of specific situation or something that you'd experienced that there wasn't enough diversity being represented?
Yeah, I mean, I guess New Zealand is so small, but there aren't really like many promoters or collectives that kind of aim to prioritise or focus on marginalised groups. So I guess that's kind of why I wanted to start there. And also, being a woman, I have like experienced firsthand sexism in the music industry, whether that is me being a promoter or me as a performer. So yeah, I just wanted to create like a space for marginalised groups.
If you don't mind me asking, what kind of things have you experienced? Is it just not really been taken as seriously as other people, or?
Well, I've got a couple of stories. Like one show I did, I played with K2K and we tried to get backstage, but the bouncer didn't believe that we were performing. And it took us getting other male performers to convince the bouncer that we were actually performing. So that was a good one. Another one was I played at a bar last year and I was using my DJ controllers because this is when I just first started getting into DJing. And after I performed, a guy came up to me telling me that I should be using CDJs and that he would like to invite me to his all-female rookie DJ night and teach me how to DJ, but it was like an extremely condescending way, not in like a helpful way, just like, I'm going to take care of all these women who don't know how to DJ and show them how to use their equipment.
When you tell someone about a story like that, are they like, does that resonate with people? People do have experienced the same thing as you?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I can't think of like specific stories, but it's definitely out there and it's happening. I think that we're slowly kind of getting better as people are talking about it more, but it's definitely still happening to marginalised groups, which is just it's just not okay.
Mm.
People maybe don't take us as seriously, but I don't know why, because I can do it just as good.
Well, and it's just like, did you see that there was a piece in the Otago Daily Times about...
Yes, I was just reading that.
Oh my gosh, so it's like, even when people are doing well, so yeah, that was about the Silver Scrolls and that all being women, when they are doing well and are being taken seriously, there's still a backlash.
Yeah, it's almost like if you're doing well, it's credited to your gender rather than just doing well, and if you're doing bad, it's credited to your gender. So I don't know how to win. It's like all those Silver Scroll nominees actually just have really amazing songs. It doesn't matter that they're women, they're amazing artists and they deserve to be credited.
So what kind of response have you had to Moments? Have you had a lot of support with that?
Yes, I've had mostly good support. I think I've had one person comment on that New Zealand's too small for me to be trying to do something like that, which I completely disagree with. I think it's really important to kind of keep going. But yeah, mostly it's been really positive, and from the parties that I've thrown, I've had people come up to me after saying that it's been like, not only like was the musicians really great, but the vibe of the shows has been really nice and they felt comfortable, and that's kind of what I'm aiming to do with those shows, is to create like a nice, comfortable space for people to be themselves in.
So do you do that with the venues and the people that are working there, and how, like, what specific things do you do to make sure that it's comfortable for everyone?
Yeah, well, I definitely talked to the venues beforehand, saying that that's kind of what I'm aiming to do, and because it's really important to communicate with venues. Otherwise, you put up these posters saying, I don't tolerate this, but when it comes to it, like, venues might not actually kick people out. So it's really important to communicate with the venues. Yeah. I mean, the first show I did was in S&M's, which is like a gay bar, so they obviously don't tolerate any sort of homophobia there, so that was good. But yeah, always stay in contact with the venues and the security guards if you can. I think those are really important steps to take as a promoter to ensure the safety of the punters.
And I see that you've got a show coming up in Auckland in November, yep. Is it?
Yeah, November 4th with myself, K2K, Alexa Casino and Dozer, who's a new DJ. And that's going to be at Whammy Backrooms. I'm really excited to take Moments on tour from Wellington to Auckland.
Big,
big, big move. taking the steps.
Moving up in the world. So what are your plans? Like, so you're studying commercial music. Do you want to go keep doing this as a career, or?
Yeah, definitely. I just really enjoy helping curate lineup. I've currently got a New Year's thing happening in the works, which isn't really got anything to do with moments, but I'm really enjoying helping people curate their lineups and trying to put a little diversity in there. Diversity has never hurt anyone before. So I guess, yeah, I definitely like want to keep moments going and also just work with other people to help them curate lineups, I think.
What advice would you have for another promoter who maybe doesn't consider, yeah, things like making somewhere really safe or somewhere, but wants to kind of get into that line of thinking? What would be some first steps?
Do your research on artists around you and ask people for recommendations. I think, like, it doesn't hurt to ask people. I think it's really important to, like, stay in conversations and, like, yeah, research, because I know that right now Moments is, like, pretty white because I'm the only person running it. So, you know, I'm still continuing to, like, grow and learn, and that's all we can really do is just do your research and try hard to, yeah, to find other people that you wouldn't necessarily hear about in your immediate group of friends, because it always makes shows more interesting.
Yeah, and it will appeal to so many more people as well. Because
exactly. Yeah. If you have a diverse lineup, then you generally will have a more diverse crowd, which makes shows a lot more comfortable and fun, I think.
That was The Wire.
That's the end of our show for another week. Thanks to those who spoke with us during the show today: Shane Cronin, Madama Fox, Jeff Simmons, Dr. Seven Noakes, Miriam Seifert, Six, and Emma Hall Phillips. A big thanks to my producers, Mac and Lily.
Thank you.
And thanks for being with us. We'll be back next week. Jenna's up next with the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.